the power to change.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, don't yeah, you know we're gonna have burn too many things. Too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Byrne, the Solartopia song. We got a powerful show today. I do want to start, Mark Ashe, you with us, the publisher and founder of Reader Supported News?
I am.
All right. Good to hear from you, Mark. Where are you, by the way?
I am in Northern California near the Russian River, in an area where that was affected by the recent fires.
Oh, well, you can thank PG&E for that. I hope to God we break that
have
something
up.
I want to, before we get into this, I want to compliment you on Reader Supported News. It's a great site. You've done a great thing starting it. I know you started Truth Out before that. You got a heck of a track record, and Reader Supported News is my favorite website, and I'm glad that you're rolling along with it. So thank you for your great work.
Fantastic, Harvey.
Well, you do have a piece up today complimenting Congress, and I don't want to let this one go by. On having finally passed an anti-lynching bill. It only took two centuries. I have done a lot of reading on the New Deal, and this was in the 1930s. There was a tremendous fight over an anti-lynching bill, and Franklin Roosevelt wouldn't support it because he had too many Southern white Democrats that he was beholden to. And so it's taken all these years, almost 5,000 lynchings in this country, and you have a piece by Jack Crosby up there talking about finally the Congress has passed an anti-lynching bill. So I just got one thing to say to the Congress, mazel tov, it's about time. I did watch last night, by the way, the Spike Lee movie. Have you seen this one, Mark, The Black Klansman? It's quite amazing.
I did not see it.
Yeah, well, it's definitely worth seeing. So you, among your many talents, have been writing regularly at Reader Supported News, and you recently had a piece about Trump and espionage. And I'm reminded of another great title from the 1960s of a book called None Dare Call It Treason. Why don't you expound, tell us a bit more about your thinking on espionage when it comes to Donald Trump.
Well, what we're really looking at here is we have, I think we'd really like to know what the level of cooperation is between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. To what extent is he providing aid and assistance? To what extent was he remunerated? If he was remunerated and there were understandings that he would do certain things, they were contrary to the national security interests of the United States of America, then, yeah, he's basically dancing with espionage.
Well, here's your quote here. Espionage, basically, as you put it, is willfully compromising U.S. national security to serve the interests of a hostile foreign power. Are you saying that this is what Donald Trump has done with Vladimir Putin?
Well, I said in the title that I said espionage is not out of the question. Here's the problem. Everybody wants to know what Robert Mueller knows. But I think if you take a look at the trajectory of his investigation, the people he's talking to, and what we know on the public record in what terms of what Donald Trump was engaged in, his financial transactions, his contact with the Russians, his desire to build a big project in Russia, All these things happened at about the same time, and there were discussions, pointed discussions in terms of removing sanctions or relieving sanctions, and things that would remunerate both Vladimir Putin and his associates. So,
well, as of today, now, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, at the end of the day, what you're wondering there is there a quid pro quo? And we don't know that yet. But sure, I mean, he was definitely sick of.
Yeah. If Trump got paid off to do any of this stuff by Putin, what's the difference, Mark Ash, between espionage and treason? I mean,
treason is very, very, very limited. Treason, there aren't any laws against treason. Treason is not, there are no statutes, federal statutes against treason. Treason is a provision in the Constitution. And it's a very, very narrow, you have to give aid and comfort to an enemy at a time of war. This is a very narrow provision. People have been prosecuted for treason, but it hasn't happened since the Second World War. There really isn't any way to define Donald Trump's contacts with Vladimir Putin. We are not at war with Russia, so you really can't define it as treason. Espionage is what almost everyone who effectively provides a material action, it could be information, it could be documents, it could be a number of things, but a material action to a hostile foreign power, particularly when there's remuneration. That is to say, I was the individual was paid X amount of dollars and provided X documents to foreign power and was caught and tried. That's espionage. Donald Trump is doing favors for Vladimir Putin. Absolutely. Are those exclusively within the scope of his powers of the presidency, or has he deliberately used the powers of the presidency to go outside of what he knows to be U.S. national interest, security interest? And was he remunerated? If he was remunerated and he did those things knowingly, willfully, against the advice of all of his advisors, you're dancing with espionage. Yes, it meets the guidelines.
Okay, we're talking with Mark Ash. By the way, we're going to be joined, and Mark, I hope you'll stay with us if you can. At 20
sure.
minutes after the hour, we're going to be joined by Medea Benjamin of Code Pink to talk about
Medea.
The Syria and Lebanon votes, Yemen votes in the Congress. And at 40 minutes afterwards, we're going to be joined by Jody Evans, also of Code Pink, talk about the Green New Deal and those situations that are starting to arise with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the push for a major reconstruction of our infrastructure around renewable energy. We're with Mark Ash now, the founder and publisher of Reader Supported News. Mark, I have written on Reader Supported News about various aspects of Trump's financial history with Putin. Now, we know without any doubt that Trump's entire financial house of cards, let's put it that way, has been dependent on Russian billionaire money, money laundering in particular, since the 1980s. And that Trump really, in strict financial terms, is owned by Vladimir Putin. I do not think that's an overstatement. So,
I think there are some instances that are better documented than others. Certainly, the sale of the house in Florida that was valued at $45 million and sold for close to $80 million, and is now some years later been appraised or resold for $56 million, that's just clear money laundering right there. I mean, that's open and shut. Okay.
But he has, according to Craig Unger and his book, House of Trump, House of Putin, I've interviewed Craig a number of times and cited his work. I've read his book a couple of times, actually. Trump did about 1,300 real estate transactions with Russian oligarchs since the 1980s. And, you know, at one point he was $4 to $6 billion in debt and facing numerous bankruptcies. And then suddenly he's flinging cash all over Fifth Avenue. And as best we can tell, his flagship Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan is essentially a dormitory for Russian oligarchs. So and of course all the oligarchs in Russia are tied in one way or another, or under the thumb in one way or another, Vladimir Putin. So where do you think the dovetailing is between Trump's financial dealings with the Putin-controlled oligarchs and his, say, foreign and domestic policies?
Well, what I think, and what the federal prosecutors are prepared to file, may be two different things. What I think is that if, in fact, he was remunerated, and in fact, he took actions that he knew to be contrary to U.S. national security and the best interest of the United States of America, in his capacity as president of the United States, with the aid, assistance, and remuneration of a hostile foreign power, then he has committed espionage. Yes.
Filing that
and documenting it in a court of law is a higher threshold.
Right. Now, there is one instance of treason that we have had, certainly, of a president of the United States since World War II, although he wasn't quite president at the time. But Richard Nixon in 1968 was the Republican nominee for president of the United States. And we have, without a doubt, this is no longer conspiracy theory. This is conspiracy fact. We know that he ordered his liaison to the South Vietnamese government, Madame Chenault, the wife of the founder of the Flying Tigers, to call the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, and tell them to not sign a peace deal with Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson himself referred to that as treason. I think he has a case, frankly. Why Lyndon Johnson never made that public is beyond me at this point. But we know it happened. Do you think that Donald Trump has done anything to on that level?
Well, let me put it this way. I'm not sure that necessarily meets the constitutional definition of treason. But I understand where you're going, and I certainly saw that wonderful documentary that was produced by MSNBC with narration by Rachel Maddow. I think she did a great job. There are really three instances that I'm aware of that could rise to the level of treason, or that form of treason. I want to be careful here. Treasonous conduct, and I'm going to use treasonous as a descriptive of treason, not necessarily formal treason. Formal treason, again, is a very, very narrow statute. It's easy to search out on the internet, and I advise everyone to do that. But there are really three instances that really fell into that particular genre. Richard Nixon was, to the best of my knowledge, the first to cross and speak at a time of war, to speak to a hostile power and try and, you know, manipulate events to his political advantage. The next was Ronald Reagan negotiating with the Iranians, who are holding American hostages, not to release the hostages so he could win the election. Yikes. Okay, that's really bad.
I'll agree with that. That's the October surprise.
Really bad. Then you've got Donald Trump collaborating, and I believe he did collaborate with Vladimir Putin and the Russians and Julian Assange to release to his advantage the stolen emails and help coordinate an illicit campaign of promotion for his presidency. I don't think it was as bad as what Ronald Reagan did. I don't think it's as bad as what Richard Nixon did. But it's bad. It falls into the same genre, certainly.
Wow. We're talking with Mark Ash, the editor and publisher of Reader Supported News. He's had many pieces on there. His most recent one, I believe, is Espionage is Not Out of the Question. And, you know, it struck me when I first read it that you did avoid the T word, the treason word, which I've used numerous times. And, you know, I remember being accused of being a conspiracy theorist when we put out the idea that Nixon had interfered with the peace talks. I did a lot of, in 1968, I did a lot of work on the October surprise. And, you know, it wasn't so much Reagan personally. I would bet you that they kept Reagan out of the loop on that one, but it was George H.W. Bush and William Casey who very clearly, to my mind, negotiated with the Iranians to keep the hostages in Iran during the 1980 presidential campaign. To my mind, there's very little doubt about that, although we don't have a smoking gun to the equivalent of what we have from 1968. 1968, we have actual tapes of phone conversations between Nixon and Madame Chenault, and then between Madame Chenault and the Vietnamese. So there's no doubt about that one. I'd say we're 95% there on the October surprise with Trump and the presidential campaign. I think we're getting awful close, and it's awful quick. I mean, it took a long, long time for the stuff about Nixon and 68 to come out. We're still fighting to confirm the October surprise in 1980. We're only 2 years out from the 2016 election. That's pretty quick and something of this magnitude.
Absolutely.
And I'm having arguments with people about Mueller. I have to say, I think, and I'm interested in your opinion on this. I think Mueller is actually the real deal. I mean, I don't know how many indictments and convictions he's racked up, but it's a pretty formidable death toll here, and he doesn't show any signs of slowing down. What do you think of Mueller?
Well, I think Bob Mueller is exactly what he appears to be. He's a hard-nosed prosecutor, and he's somebody that doesn't back off. He's referred to in many by people that know him and people that work with him as a as a prosecutorial assassin. He's not considered to be the nicest guy. He basically, if they want you in prison, he comes from a genre, a mindset of federal prosecutors and law enforcement officials who, if they want you in prison, they'll get you there. If they can't get you one way, they'll get you another. And he'll get who he's after here. And I believe he's after Donald Trump, and I believe he'll get him.
You mean after all the nice things that Trump has said about Bob Mueller?
Well, it's not just about Bob Mueller. First of all, he railroaded Donald Trump railroaded several major high-ranking Justice Department officials, one of which was Jim Comey, who was, by the way, not a big fan favorite of mine. But at the end of the day, he was railroaded. He was the director of the FBI. And Donald Trump was doing that to undermine the rule of law and convert the role of rule of law to his own process for his own benefit. But there was also James Baker, who was lead counsel for the FBI, chief counsel for the FBI. Peter Strzok was another one that got railroaded. I mean, they really laid a lot of these guys out. That really isn't going to sit well. And if they have something they can get Donald Trump on, they're going to get him. I'll tell you right now. Again, bear in mind, Bob Mueller's not, he hasn't made friends. Not everybody loves Bob Mueller. John Kiriakou, who was railroaded by the Justice Department, was primarily one of the key players in that prosecution, was Bob Mueller. In fact, John Kiriakou was arrested by Peter Strzok.
Oh, my God.
He was railroaded on trumped-up charges. So it's still the FBI that we know and love over the years, right? We know who they are.
Yeah.
But in this particular instance, Donald Trump, at this point, is trying to destroy federal law enforcement to protect his own ass, just like he was Don Trumpiglione.
Yes. Can I say real quick about John Kiriakou?
That needs to stop.
John Kiriakou has had stuff published at Reader Supported News. Tell us real quick who he is. Remind our listeners who he is.
John Kiriakou was a CIA agent. He was an expert in counterterrorism. He worked directly under the supervision of then Secretary of State John Kerry. He was a key, one of the best regarded and best respected counterterrorism officers the CIA had. He became concerned about what was going on with torture. He had complained to his supervisors that he thought that the policies surrounding torture and the execution of those policies by federal law enforcement agents, including CIA agents, was probably unlawful, and he was deeply concerned about it. He expressed those concerns to his superiors, and through a series of confrontations, he came to a point where he believed that he thought he was going to get railroaded. So he went,
and he did.
He went on.
He did get railroaded.
He went on a national broadcast with Brian Ross from ABC News, and he said some things that didn't set well. And they proceeded to railroad him. And one of the guys that was involved there was John Brennan, who was then the director of the CIA. Robert Mueller was involved. It was not pretty.
Kiriakou was in prison for what, a couple of years?
Nearly 4 years.
Oh, my God. God, that's awful. We're talking with Mark Asher, the publisher and editor of Reader Supported News. We're awaiting Medea Benjamin. Medea, are you on with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, Harvey.
Oh, you're here. Okay, good to have you here. So you and Mark are acquainted with each other. Mark's been, and I've been talking about the Trumpocalypse here, or what I call Trump exit. I am, by the way, predicting that Donald Trump will be gone by April 22nd. I just put $10 into a party pool over the weekend, so we'll see if I win. Medea, you are one of the great activists of our generation. You are a co-founder of Code Pink. You have been involved in peace, women's rights, and so many other issues over the years. Mark's going to stick with us, and I want to ask you very specifically, this is a huge couple of events that have happened on issues that, at which you are center stage. Trump has now announced that he wants to pull troops out of Syria, and far more important to me in my mind is that the Congress, the Senate, has voted with a Republican majority to no longer fund the Syrian presence in Yemen. And to me, this is important, A, because it indicates a crack in the stone wall of the Republican support for Donald Trump, and also, maybe even more important in the long term, a possible crack in our imperial stone wall. Medea, as only you can, tell us, please, what you think about this.
Well, it's not as broad as you said. It's to stop the U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. It doesn't call for an end to the weapon sales, which I think should be the next thing on the agenda, but it does call for the U.S. to stop providing the refueling of the planes, the logistical support, the maintenance of the weapons, and all else that would be considered part of aiding the, quote, hostilities in Yemen. And it's very important because of the message it sends. It's also very important because it is the first time since the 1973 enactment of the War Powers Act, that the war powers have actually been used to assert Congress's authority. So it's and we've already seen the effect, even though it will be reintroduced in the House and the Senate in January, past the Senate in December. We already see the impact of it because the Saudis see the writing on the wall, and they have been more amenable to the talks that just took place in Sweden to try to find ways to get a negotiated solution in the long term, and in the short term at least guarantee that humanitarian aid would be able to get through the main port of Hodeidah. So all of that is extremely important.
I think it's mind-boggling, actually, and it's something that Code Pink deserves a lot of credit for. You have been campaigning on issues like this for a long time. How much of this vote, you can consider it to a certain extent an anti-Saudi vote, how much of it do you think had to do with the butchery of Jamal Khashoggi?
There was already a lot of momentum before Khashoggi's death to invoke the War Powers Act, and then there were some votes that were related to cutting off certain precision munitions to the Saudis that were being used in Yemen, and the Senate came close to passing those. So Khashoggi put it over the edge. It brought in a number of Republicans who weren't with us on this issue before. So it's been important, but the numbers had kept increasing pretty much with each vote. And with the greater media coverage of the catastrophe in Yemen, I would say in the last 6 months, the American public has started to see the results of the Saudi bombing with U.S. help. In fact, there were even reports by CNN that we had never seen in the mainstream media before that actually looked at the markings on the bombs that were used, for example, to kill over 40 school children when they crushed their bus, and saying that these are Lockheed Martin and Raytheon bombs that were being used. So there was there has been more public attention paid to this issue, more opposition in general, and that together with the Khashoggi murder has really made this an issue that has enough support in both the House and the Senate to be passed when it's reintroduced in January.
Well, in the shorter term now, a lot of us, you know, who are pulling for the Trump exit, the departure of Donald Trump, took this in the short term as an indication that there were, if there were enough Republicans to break with him on this vote to continue funding the Saudi Holocaust in Yemen, that there might be eventually enough Republican votes to remove him from office in an impeachment trial. Do you want to comment on that real quick, and then we'll go back to foreign policy?
Well, just on the foreign policy, we don't know if there's enough votes to override a Trump veto if we do get it to his desk on this issue of the War Powers resolution. So even there, we're not sure how many Republicans we can hold on to. And I think this is also probably related to Trump's announcement of pulling out the troops from Syria. So it's all related, and we don't know from day to day, week to week, month to month, where this is leading.
Well, what do you think then? Of course, there's immediately a lot of pushback on the Syria vote, is saying he's just doing it to out of fealty to Vladimir Putin, because it certainly serves Putin's interest. What do you say to that about the pullout from Syria?
I don't know why he did it. There's others who say that it was to shore up his base, since it was a promise that he made while campaigning. And certainly the polls show that there is no appetite among the American people to continue the U.S. involvement in the never-ending wars in Syria and the Middle East in general. This, you would not know this from hearing the D.C. elite pundits on the liberal and the right side who have been complaining tremendously about this move. but it really is one that is popular not only with Trump's base, but with the public in general.
So here's the big picture question. And Mark, yes, you're welcome to jump in on this one. Can we see a glimmer of any kind of hope here of Donald Trump, of all people, pulling our troops out of somewhere? I don't remember the United States pulling troops out of anywhere. Obama allegedly pulled some out of Iraq, but and left them all in Afghanistan, for God's sakes. Is there any glimmer that this might be some kind of turning point in the American imperial presence in the world, which is, of course, what Code Pink has been in the vanguard of working on for so long?
Mark, did you want to comment on that?
Well, yeah, I think it's really difficult to say. He doesn't seem to have a great deal of credibility with the other key players in the government that would really have anything to say. I mean, the Pentagon doesn't take him very seriously. Congress, every time he really tries to act with any kind of real authority, Congress seems to intercede and kind of create impediments for him to do that. So I really don't know that he's going to be able to move the equation one way or the other. It would be fair to say that he hasn't started any wars that have gotten a lot of people killed yet. So I guess to that extent, it's kind of nice. But whether or not he's going to be able to really move, I mean, there are situations where you really don't want him to move foreign policy. I mean, the U.S. relationship with NATO over the years, however productive of negative things, and it has been productive of some negative things, still and yet, it's been the anchor of the Western Democratic Alliance for decades. He seems to think that he'd like to undermine that.
Yeah, that's true. Medea,
I would love to see
I have
undermining of NATO. I think NATO is as Trump said in his campaigning, he said it was obsolete. It certainly should be obsolete. It should have ended when the World War II ended, and it should, and it's causing more potential conflicts in the world with the bringing in of countries closer and closer to Russia's border. It's been very antagonistic, and Trump is now only encouraging the countries within NATO to spend more money on their military, something that their own people have been opposing. You ask the French people if they want to spend more money on the military? I don't think so. Ask anybody in Europe. So I think NATO is problematic, and I think it's problematic that Trump has embraced NATO. In fact, NATO will be coming and being hosted in Washington, D.C. in April, and many of us in the anti-war movement will be there to oppose NATO.
Well, I have an ulterior motive here. I'm about to publish my own history of the United States. It's the 40th anniversary upcoming of Howard Zinn's People's History, and so mine is kind of Howard's book on acid. And I would love to be able to say that in 2019 or 2018, a corner was turned on the global empire when we pulled out of Syria. Is it way, way, way out of line to even begin to think that, Medea?
I think it's too early to tell. I think the corner will be turned when the U.S. pulls out of Afghanistan, because that has been now 17 years plus. Trump has talked about getting troops out of there, but hasn't done it. I think if he does that, we can mark that as a milestone. But 2,000 troops in Syria, while the U.S. continues to be involved in bombing campaigns in Syria, we haven't seen yet if the troops are even getting pulled out. We don't know about special command forces in Syria. I think it's too early to say that.
Well, where do we stand in Iraq? How many troops, Medea, do we still have in Iraq? Is there any indication that anything Obama did was meaningful in terms of pulling out of there?
Well, there's about 5,000 troops left in Iraq. It was meaningful that the number of troops was reduced. That's positive. But the U.S. has really had a very difficult time in Iraq because Iraq borders on Iran. There are many Iraqis who have long-standing relationships with Iran that are both religious and political. The U.S. invasion took out a Sunni government and put a Shia one in. And so it's quite ironic that after the U.S. toppled the government of Saddam Hussein, it came to the awareness that there's never going to be a government in Iraq that really doesn't have some Iranian influence in it. And this has been hard for the U.S. to swallow.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, and of course, the attack on Libya wound up opening the floodgates of immigration into, or you know, refugees into Europe. It's always the law of unintended consequences. Medea, you've been campaigning for peace for so long. How do you feel that your efforts have impacted us, and where do you think we're heading? Small question.
Well, I think that we, in the broad sense, as a much larger movement, have been able to stave off a war with Iran, and I hope that despite the Bush love affair with Israel and Saudi Arabia, both of whom would love the U.S. to get involved in a military conflict in Iran, we're able to keep that off the table. And I think it will be time with the new members of Congress and people like Bernie Sanders, who are starting to bring it up more, addressing the issue of the staggering budget for the Pentagon and how this impedes all of the positive things that many people are calling for, whether it's the Green New Deal or the Medicare for All. We need to look at the biggest pot of money there is, and that's the Pentagon budget. And this is something that Donald Trump has been back and forth about, saying that it was crazy how large it is and then proposing more increases. So I think that's something that we have to come together on in the different movements to really understand the need to rein in the Pentagon budget and liberate funds that we so desperately need for good things.
Do you see an evolution? This is you know, something that popped into my head a while ago, that there might be actually a peace caucus in the Congress?
Well, that's a great idea, given that there's an F-35 caucus and a drone caucus and a caucus for all these different weapons. You would think that the progressive caucus would be a peace caucus, but it really isn't. So I think that's a great idea.
Well, it occurred to me, and this is, being a historian, this was my pipe dream, that Barbara Lee would chair a peace caucus, and it'll be the Rankin Lee Peace Caucus, because you know Jeanette Rankin and Barbara Lee in the history of the United States Congress are the only two people to cast a solitary vote for peace. Jeanette Rankin, of course, was elected to Congress in 1916 and was one of 50 Congress people to vote against World War One. And she, of course, was the only liberal woman. She was the first woman elected to Congress. And then she came back to Congress in 1940 and was the only member of either house of Congress to vote against the declaration of war in World War II. And then Barbara Lee, of course, cast her sole vote for peace. I would love to see a women's peace caucus or non-exclusively peace caucus in the Congress. I think it's way overdue. Mark Ash, you want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, you know, I go back to Dennis Kucinich, and I go back to his efforts for so long in Congress. There really haven't been very many members of Congress that were really outspoken about defining a peace initiative, defining initiatives that would enhance the chances for peace long term. There really have been very, very few.
Well, our peace Congress,
I guess Ron Dellums was pretty good. Obviously, Dennis Kucinich was good.
Well, we have Paul Pick, which has been our Code Pink has been our de facto peace caucus in the country, and it's been very, very effective. And Medea, we certainly want to thank you for your increased efforts here. Do you see more Republicans breaking with Trump on issues like this? I mean, you've been instrumental in getting at least some to break on this Syria war. Were there any more that you could foresee coming over?
Well, we saw people that you would never have thought would come over on the issue of curtailing U.S. support to Saudi Arabia. And those are people like Lindsey Graham and Senator Corker and Marco Rubio. I mean, who would have ever thought? But they were very upset by the Khashoggi incident. Their hearts were not softened by the pictures of the dying children, but the murder of a Washington Post journalist really did get to them. I don't think that we can count them on our side for very much. It's been very hard to get significant numbers of Republicans other than Rand Paul and Mike Lee from Utah. It's hard to get them consistently to oppose the war agenda. And of course, as you know well, Harvey, if you do a little correlation between the contributions to their campaigns from the weapons companies, the Israel lobby, the Saudi lobby, it will give your listeners an indication of why they continue to support wars that are so unpopular with the American people. But I do have a lot of hope with the incoming Congress that we will get some real champions who we can work with to think outside the box and introduce new measures that would really be very visionary in terms of how we could move away from wars and into a foreign policy that really focuses on diplomacy, not just in words, but in deeds.
Well, that will segue us into the Green New Deal. Jody Evans, have you come on yet? Jody's not with us yet. She's scheduled to come in at 40 after
Hi,
the
Harvey,
hour.
I'm here.
So, Medea, oh, you are here. Jody Evans, you're with
yeah.
us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Excellent. Okay, so, Medea, I know you may have to go. You're welcome to stay on if you like and continue with Mark Ash as well. But we're joined by Jody Evans, the other co-founder of Code Pink, and we're going to segue a little bit away from our foreign policy discussion to the Green New Deal.
Great. I'll just say and, thank you, Harvey and Mark, and thank you for the time on your show and to talk about these critical issues.
Well, thank you, Medea, for your years of dedicated, hard, and very effective work, and it's an honor to have you on the show, as it is to have Jody Evans. So, Jody, you're talking to us from Southern California, I believe. Mark is in Northern California, so we're now an all California show here. With the Green New Deal is getting a lot of play now, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is coming in with it. It's in the form some kind of resolution at this point. There's a lot of talk about forming a caucus in the Congress, even a committee in the House to deal with the Green New Deal. And I want to make sure that we start with you and tell us what you're thinking about the Green New Deal and where you think it might go.
Oh, and we're very excited about the possibility of a Green New Deal. And, you know, the Green Party has been carrying one for quite a while, and now that it's being picked up by Alexandria and others, it's very exciting because their leadership is fresh and it's just kind of blowing down the opposition. We've just, asked them to consider including U.S. military as an environmentally destructive force, and that enormous budget, which is over 60% of our taxes in discretionary spending, and move it over to how we would have the revenue for some of the green initiatives that they're proposing. So we have a petition on our website calling on them to include the bloated military budget as a source of revenue and also ending the environmental impact of militarism.
Well, that's a great thing. Of course, the term New Deal harkens back to Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, Eleanor is never sufficiently mentioned in discussing the original New Deal, but it was really Eleanor who was the architect of a lot of it. She gave Franklin at least one memo a day and wrote a national column every day. I mean, as a writer, Mark, you and I would know what a taxing job that would be for someone to be First Lady of the United States, do all she did and put out a column every day that was syndicated in virtually all the newspapers in the country. I do have a pet issue, and I want to raise it here with you, Jody, and Mark, about the Green New Deal, which is the need to avoid nuclear power in the Green New Deal. Having been in that movement for more than 40 years, inevitably you see the interests of the nuclear power industry trying to sneak their way in. And I did send a query to the Sunshine Movement about shutting nuclear plants, and they have come back. The response I got was that they do not support new nuclear plants, but they do also not support shutting nuclear plants if those plants are going to be replaced with fossil fuels. And I want to make it clear my position, which is that any nuclear plant that's shut should be, part of the deal is they should be immediately replaced by fossil fuels. Those of us in California are all too familiar with the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plants, where Pacific Gas and Electric has conceded that those two reactors could be shut and replaced entirely with renewables right now. Jody, what are the other aspects of the Green New Deal that are most important to you?
Well, I mean, also that we should remember that this is about creating a coalition to do this work, so we don't know what it is, and it's great that we continue to bring up some of the pieces that we want to make sure are brought into it, because I'm sure it's going to be a major lobbying effort and hopefully bring a lot of people into the conversation. And just a reminder that we don't have enough conversations about what's happening in our country and how we can participate and how we can learn. And just the fact that this opens up the dialogue, that it allows people to talk about what is possible and what can happen, part of what I feel is that it could open us up to all kinds of things that have been shut down and allow us to think even bigger. Because, you know, we see this in the anti-war movement, that the conversation becomes very narrowed by false choices and by having this Green New Deal where it is a conversation, where it's going to be debate and dialogue, just allows us to talk about things that aren't talked about, that are shut out of Congress and out of debate. For me, that's going to be one of the most important parts.
So, the original New Deal included, of course, a tremendous amount of work programs. The CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, for example, built trails and other facets in the national park system. There was the Works Progress Administration, the Public Works Administration that did, there was a lot of art, you know, murals and programs and schools. There's a lot of school building. And of course, the centerpiece, as best I can tell, and certainly in my own particular interest, is the conversion to renewable energy. Where do you see that playing out? What do you see as the principal tangible accomplishments that we're looking for once we get our coalitions together, Jody Evans?
Oh, definitely moving to a green economy. And those, you know, many paths are laid for that to be possible and to be exposed. I've just been reading that the cost of creating green energy has gone down tremendously. I was part of Jerry Brown's cabinet when he was first governor, and the Office of Appropriate Technology was under my office, and that's where wind energy and solar energy were able to be funded and founded, because they got tax breaks. And you look at what it was then and what it is now, the capacity, I mean, you've moved the numbers down to where the arguments are that this is the economic way to go. We see that in the divest movement, that, you know, when in the divest from fossil fuel movement, that's where the money is. It's where the gains are happening. And again, it's going to be where we're going to be able to look and see what's really been hiding in plain sight. That is what's exciting. Because all this is happening.
Mark Ash, do you want to jump in, the editor and publisher of Reader's Support News?
Well, I think Jody's doing a really good job. She has a really deep understanding of this issue. You know, a green economy is something that we've struggled for a long time. It's faced a lot of resistance. When you start talking about a green economy, you start talking about shifting a good deal of revenue from traditional energy producers. And when you see Donald Trump, you know, rolling around the countryside extolling the virtues of coal, you get a clear picture of how difficult reversing the economic realities of a fossil fuel economy can be. You're taking money out of the pockets of people who don't want money taken out of their pockets. And they can be difficult to deal with. And they can always find somebody like Donald Trump who will basically promote their agenda. And many of those individuals exist within the Democratic Party.
That's a very good point.
You also have people that are suffering climate change, and that number is growing. So, you know, there's new coalitions that will be formed around this where the losses are real. It's not something they talk about anymore. It's something people are experiencing. And it's pretty devastating, and the activism that's happening out of some of these communities is going to surprise people.
Yes, and the really good news is, you know, when we first started fighting nuclear power back in the 70s, people asked us what we were going to replace it with, and we sort of just kind of pulled out of the air wind and solar. We really didn't. They sounded good. We didn't know anything about them. And it's been really one of the great technological miracles of the last 50 years that wind and solar have absolutely blown away all previous prognostications. I mean, it is cheaper now to shut a nuclear plant, build a wind farm, and operate it than it is to continue to operate the nuclear plant. And the same with solar. And as you pointed out, Mark, a lot of this has to do with who gets the money. The beauty of solar, especially rooftop solar, is that it shifts the resources from the corporations to the individual homeowners and apartment dwellers. And it's a really decentralizing, democratizing technological transformation. And that's, I think, Jody, as we move ahead in fighting for the New Deal, that's going to be the core of the pushback is going to be corporate. Because when we talk about a Green New Deal that has a centerpiece of wind and solar, and especially rooftop solar, we're talking about a massive redistribution of wealth and of power.
Well, so a few years ago, during the Obama administration, one of the things we looked at as we had been trying to end war for many years was that we're not going to end war until we end the war economy. And so a lot of, you know, our local work at Code Pink is in how do we create local peace economies and getting, you know, getting things like locally owned, locally connected energy, taking it back, taking it smaller. And so I want to say that also these technologies work for getting off grids, getting you know, out of the ownership of major corporations and being able to do it ourselves. And with global climate change and global inequality and $1.4 trillion of weapons sold each year, you know, that level of instability means that we do need to start remembering what it is to live in peace and to take care of each other and to learn what it is to create and grow local peace.
Oh, my God. Jody, you are wonderful. Thank you so much, Jody Evans. Code Pink, Mark Ash, from Reader Supported News. This has been Harvey Sluggo Wasserman at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Hour. We'll be back next week. Thank you both. And Medea Benjamin as well. Thank you so much.
We're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.